As is quite evident in the conversations with Drs. Chris and Perez Soler, a great deal of attention is now being directed at the EGFR pathway as a means to control the progression of non-small cell lung cancer. I met with Dr. Julie Bramer for her take on where this all might be headed, and she began our conversation by commenting on predictors of response to EGFR TKIs.
There's kind of two camps of thought. Some investigators believe that EGFR mutations are where the answer lies, and other people feel that EGFR gene expression, as measured by FISH, is where the answer really is. But I think none of the studies so far have really pointed the direction one way versus another. We know that patients who are treated with EGFR inhibitors will respond better if you have an EGFR mutation. However, the big question is, will they live longer? And at least in the large trial that looked at this retrospectively, the Canadian trial that looked at Tarceva or erlotinib versus placebo, the EGFR mutations did not live any longer than those patients who were treated with the same erlotinib if they did not have those mutations. So that really did not bear out. However, for the increased EGFR expression by FISH, those patients did live longer when they were treated with erlotinib. So in that trial, it looked more like the increased EGFR by gene expression actually was where the answer really was. But there's going to be some data probably coming out at ASCO this year, hopefully with the INTEREST trial looking at gefitinib versus docetaxel. And I think actually there may be some reversal of that information in that trial. So I don't think we have any of the answers regarding EGFR overexpression by FISH versus mutation when it comes to the answer of will those patients live longer. But I think we know that patients with EGFR mutations will respond better to Tarceva. And I think some of the first-line trials where they're looking at Tarceva just in those patients with mutations, that's where I think we're going to get our answers. Should we move Tarceva or erlotinib up to the first line in those patients with mutations versus waiting down the road? I don't think the mutations are going to be able to tell us whether or not one patient may live longer with that drug versus another, but I think a patient with EGFR mutations probably in the end will need to get Tarceva up front rather than chemotherapy. And there's some large trials, particularly one from Spain, that is comparing Tarceva or erlotinib versus chemotherapy in that select group of patients with EGFR mutations. There's another trial here in the United States, the CALGB trial, that actually is not looking specifically at mutations, but at those patients who are never smokers and randomizing them to erlotinib or chemotherapy. So I think that hopefully in the near future we'll have the information about whether or not to move erlotinib up front in that particular patient population.
What about patients who are non-smokers who don't have either the mutation or FISH amplifications? Do they have greater response to these agents?
We don't know yet. There is a chance that those patients may have different mutations. Remember, most of the mutations that people are actually measuring are in particular locations of the EGFR receptor gene. And so there may be other genetic changes that we're just not measuring at this point. So a non-smoker may or may not respond to the drug and may or may not have the mutation, but still can respond, or particularly, probably is most important, not so much the response, but maintaining their disease, keeping the disease under control.
You mentioned KRAS, and we see a lot of interest and excitement in that in colon cancer, particularly with regard to EGFR antibodies. Where do we know about KRAS and EGFR TKIs in non-small cell?
Well, right now, the thought is that at least some of the studies have shown that patients who have KRAS mutations will not respond to the EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors. So people are now looking at that to see whether or not that can predict those patients who truly won't benefit at all or actually their tumors grow right through the EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors. But there's no prospective data looking at that.
Now, I'm starting to hear people talking about maybe integrating KRAS into clinical management in colon cancer. Do you see that happening in lung cancer in the near future?
I think not in the near future, but down the road. People are talking about, say, if you see a patient with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer, the things to potentially look at at least at first, is to see whether or not giving them Tarceva up front would be appropriate, looking at EGFR mutations. If they're EGFR mutation positive, one could consider using Tarceva up front rather than chemotherapy. But again, this has not been tested prospectively. Now, if a patient has KRAS mutations, then one would consider that erlotinib would not work down the road, even in the second or third line setting, and so to truly concentrate on chemotherapy potentially. But even patients with KRAS mutations aren't supposed to respond to chemotherapy that well either, so you may not have much of an option for treatment of those patients. However, again, if those patients remain stable with their disease, treated with these type of medications, I think that that's something to look forward to, and so the longer we can control their disease, the better. And I think all this data with KRAS is all retrospective. I think actually probably the most important thing is to develop different inhibitors for those patients with KRAS mutations to actually focus on that pathway rather than some of the other ones.
Overall, what would be your estimate or what do we know about the fraction of non-smokers who have tumors either with EGFR amplification or mutations?
So the fraction of non-smokers that actually have EGFR mutations, depending on what population you're looking at, can range anywhere between 20% to even 40%. And in some Asian populations, it's even up to 60%. So there's a wide range depending on the population that you look at. So if you actually live in Korea or China or Japan, the percentage of EGFR mutations are much higher compared to here in the United States with the same population, women, non-smokers, or even immigrant Asians, non-smokers.
What about other inhibitors in the EGFR pathway and specifically the antibodies? And I'm curious what we know right now about the FLEX study with cetuximab.
For right now, cetuximab is not approved for use for non-small cell lung cancer, but I think we're going to be hearing some exciting news coming out from some of the phase 3 trials looking at combination chemotherapy with or without cetuximab in our patients with metastatic disease. We know that cetuximab's been combined with vinorelbine and cisplatinum as well as paclitaxel and carboplatin. And in the past, at least in some of the phase 2 trials, there was actually mixed data, some mild improvement in response and some mixed data from when it comes to survival and progression-free survival. But now with some of the larger phase 3 trials, at least by press report, one is positive and one is negative. So I think we'll hear some more information about that. And I think this is exciting, particularly for our patients who are not eligible to receive bevacizumab with chemotherapy. It's nice to hopefully down the road be able to give them an option. Another place where I think cetuximab is going to be playing a role in non-small cell lung cancer is actually stage 3 disease, disease that can be treated with radiation therapy. And cetuximab, at least through the radiation oncology group, RTOG, has some interesting data combining cetuximab with radiation and getting some very good responses. We know cetuximab does improve response to radiation for patients with head and neck cancer.
What about other molecular agents that are targeting both EGFR as well as the VEGF pathway? And I know you've done some work on sunitinib. Can you talk about that?
Well, particularly Zactima or the ZD6474, that data is interesting, particularly in women, that actually might improve how patients do. And Dr. Hamock out of MD Anderson is the PI on most of those trials looking at combining chemotherapy with that drug. And that has some interesting data, but certainly is not yet available on the market for our patients with that disease. But it's nice to see a combination looking at EGFR inhibition as well as anti-angiogenesis.
Can you talk a little bit about what we know about ZD6474 or Zactima? It's from my understanding, it's kind of an unusual agent and has what both EGFR as well as anti-VEGF activity?
Correct. Both. And it depends on what dose. So if you're using the drug at 100 milligrams a day, that seems to have both EGFR activity as well as VEGF activity. And the higher dose, the 300 milligrams, did not seem, at least combined with chemotherapy, to improve progression-free survival. So that has led to a large phase 3 trial looking at 100 milligrams of ZD6474 or Zactima with second-line chemotherapy versus chemotherapy by itself.
What about the anti-angiogenic agents, particularly sunitinib as well as sorafenib? What do we know about that in non-small cell?
So for sunitinib, actually, We've looked at it in a phase two setting, in the second line setting, and actually it did have some responses. There was about 10% response rate in those patients who received sunitinib in that second and third line setting. This was given both on a continuous dosing regimen as well as an intermittent dosing regimen similar to what's done in renal cell carcinoma. The problem with that drug is that it does have side effects, including bleeding, so you don't get away with a decrease in hemorrhagic events. There were patients on this trial that did have hemorrhagic events. And also, a problem with this drug is that it does drop patients' blood counts. So it's the likelihood this would probably be used as a single agent in this disease, potentially in the second or third line setting. Trying to move that up in the first line setting in combination with chemotherapy is much more difficult because of the combination and the increase in toxicity, particularly a higher rate of hematologic toxicity. So I think it has a future as a single agent or potentially as a maintenance therapy, but it's hard to combine it with chemotherapy. I can't say that it won't be combined with chemotherapy, but it will be hard to combine it with chemotherapy. But it's a drug that potentially could be combined with drugs such as erlotinib or other drugs that don't decrease blood counts.
What about sorafenib?
So sorafenib, actually, Dr. Schiller, through ECOG, has looked at sorafenib in the second and third line setting, as well as Dr. Gatzmeier out of Germany looked at sorafenib in the second and third line setting. And while it didn't have much in the way of response rate, it did have some increased progression-free survival or some interesting prolonged progression-free survival. And the thought is potentially that drug combined with chemotherapy actually may enhance chemotherapy activity. And there is a first-line trial randomizing patients to either chemotherapy by itself or chemotherapy plus sorafenib. And again, this trial, we hope, will be reported this year at ASCO or in the next couple of years.
What about the side effects that are seen actually going back over all three, 6474, sunitinib, and sorafenib? You talked some about sunitinib. What has been seen in terms of side effects with the other agents?
So ZD6474 is Actemra. The main side effects are EGFR-related, so you can get rash and diarrhea, as well as rarely a drop in blood counts, but it's mainly the EGFR side effects. Sorafenib is more, it can drop your blood counts, but more some dermatologic side effects such as hand, foot.
What about bleeding, hemoptysis?
Not as much with sorafenib, and same with ZD6474, not as much. There are more events, but not as much compared to sunitinib, and certainly not as much as bevacizumab.
Now, you were a central figure in the ECOG trial 4599 that evaluated bevacizumab in non-small cell. Can you kind of provide an update on that trial as well as other data on bevacizumab in non-small cell and sort of where you see things heading?
So in this trial, we know that patients in the first-line setting with metastatic non-squamous cell carcinoma of the lung were randomized to either paclitaxel and carboplatinum or paclitaxel carboplatinum plus bevacizumab. And bevacizumab was dosed at 15 milligrams per kilogram. And also, it's important that patient selection is important because in this trial, patients could not have squamous cell carcinoma, also could not really have major hemoptysis. They could not have been on anticoagulation or even some ibuprofen and high-dose aspirin. Also, patients could not have a history of significant active coronary artery disease or stroke. And so that whittles down our patient population quite a bit. Some people estimate that type of population is anywhere between 10 to 30% of the population that's eligible for the drug. But in this trial, patients were then randomized, given the three-drug combination or just chemotherapy. They were continued on this three-drug combination until their disease progressed or if they received six cycles. So at the time of six cycles, the chemotherapy itself was dropped and patients were continued on bevacizumab by itself until progression. The other patients who were just on chemotherapy by itself received up to six cycles and then were followed with just observation. And in this trial, patients actually who received the three-drug combination improved their survival compared to those patients who received chemotherapy. The median survival was about 12 months for the three-drug combination compared to 10 months in the chemotherapy alone arm. These patients also had a higher response rate with the three-drug combination as well as a longer progression-free survival. However, this did come at a cost. There was more hematologic toxicities when patients received bevacizumab. There, of course, is more hypertension when receiving bevacizumab, and then a higher rate of hemorrhage. There were patients, even though we tried to minimize the risk of bleeding, there were patients who actually did die of hemoptysis or other bleeding events on this trial.
I know there's been a lot of effort to analyze the study to try to come up with predictors for the hemoptysis events, and it seems like it's been kind of frustrating. I guess there are not that many events. I've talked to Alan Sandler about this a number of times. Right now, what do we know about this?
Well, there's a lot of rumors going around, and some people are saying tumor location is important. Some people say it's central versus peripheral. Other people are saying cavitations. Other people are saying any history of hemoptysis. But I think the only thing that's really borne out of the small analysis that Dr. Sandler did was the presence of cavitation. So if a patient has cavitation in their tumor, I would probably avoid using bevacizumab. Location, location, location is really not quite as important because bevacizumab has been given to patients with small cell lung cancer, and those tumors are all mainly central, and there was no increased risk of bleeding in that patient population. So I don't think it's just central tumors. I think it's really cavitation.
And what about the patient who doesn't have cavitation at the beginning but develops it as part of a response?
So depending on who you talk to will depend on what's recommended. Some people recommend actually stopping bevacizumab. Other people will recommend trying to use radiation therapy in that local area to try to decrease the risk of bleeding with bevacizumab. But I think if cavitation occurs, particularly centrally, I would be worried about this patient bleeding and would seriously talk with the patient about the increased risk.
What about the issue of the patient who has treated brain mets, maybe they've already been radiated, stable, et cetera?
The dogma is out there that you don't treat a patient with any history of brain metastasis. There is a trial that's being done that is actually looking at patients with treated brain metastasis and giving them bevacizumab to truly assess the increased risk. I think the original data that swayed the group not to use this drug in patients with brain metastasis was that there was a case of a patient with breast cancer that was metastatic to the brain, and there that patient actually bled into her brain. Now, all the studies that have been done so far, except for that one study, actually excluded patients with brain metastasis, but we don't really have any published data on those patients with brain metastasis or developed brain metastasis while on the study. There was one or two patients on the ECOG 4599 that had CNS bleeds. I don't think those patients had CNS metastasis at the time.
Now, you all presented some data at the last ASCO meeting in 2007 on the 4599 study looking at older patients, and that just got published in the JCO. Can you talk about that analysis?
Yeah, that analysis actually was done looking at the elderly, and the elderly was defined as patients greater than the age of 70. And in those patients who were treated with bevacizumab and that age population actually had increased toxicities and did not have an improvement in survival when receiving the three-drug regimen compared to chemotherapy by itself. And the thought is they did not have the improvement in survival because of that increased toxicity, particularly increased hematologic toxicity and increased bleeding, including GI bleeding, and a trend towards increased treatment-related deaths. So I think while not all elderly patients are more prone to those side effects, I think it's truly patient selection. You know, if the patient is, you think, more prone to complications because of a drop in blood counts or has any hint that they might be prone to bleeding, then I would avoid using the three-drug regimen, not particularly by age, but certainly by comorbid disease as well as physical activity and then the potential for increased bleeding.
For practical purposes, if you see a patient in their 70s who otherwise meets the criteria for 4599, no comorbidities, et cetera, do you have any hesitation about using bevacizumab?
Absolutely not. I'd have more hesitation if they were in their 50s and had a history of active coronary artery disease or even potentially leg claudication. So I'd be more worried about that patient compared to the active 70-year-old with no other health problems.
When you sit down with a patient who's going to begin, let's say, carbo-paclitaxel and bevacizumab, what are some of the things that you go through with the patient, and what are some of the numbers that you give to the sort of typical patient in terms of risks?
So I pretty much quote the trial verbatim, but focus mainly on the risks of bleeding, which can run anywhere between 1 to 4%, even if we're trying to decrease their risk. And I also talk with a patient to tell me right away if they do develop hemoptysis or problems with bleeding. You'd be surprised how patients don't really tell you much, particularly about bloody noses or epistaxis or hemorrhoidal bleeding. Those things can be just as important as hemoptysis. So definitely talking with the patient about what potential things can happen and then that these are the basic risks. I also concentrate on hypertension, particularly if a patient has hypertension already. We will monitor the patient's hypertension when they come in. And a lot of times even I'll have patients check their blood pressure at home, particularly over the couple weeks after receiving bevacizumab, and to have them let me know that if they are having problems controlling their blood pressure. Proteinuria, I don't go through in detail. However, I do tell patients that we do watch for proteinuria by checking their urine every time they come in. So to kind of prepare them that that's another sample that they have to give us, but that it really doesn't have much in the way of side effects that a patient can actually feel.
What is your goal in terms of their blood pressure? What do you want to see it at?
Well, I prefer to see it less than 140 over 90. Being an oncologist and not a cardiologist, sometimes my patients will run in the 150s over 90s. But certainly I prefer it to be normal. If they've come in with normal blood pressures, I like to keep it where it is. If patients come with mildly elevated blood pressures, again, I like to keep it where it is. If people do develop blood pressures higher than that, then we usually will start them on various different medications to control their blood pressure.
What about the utilization of other chemo agents in combination with bevacizumab? There was the major trial, the AVAIL study that was reported last year. What do we know about other chemo agents with bevacizumab?
Well, in the first-line setting, bevacizumab has been combined with gemcitabine cisplatinum, and particularly in the AVAIL trial, it's interesting that they looked at two different doses of bevacizumab, and both doses, the 7.5 milligrams per kilogram and the 15 milligrams per kilogram combined with chemotherapy, improved progression-free survival compared to chemotherapy by itself. So this has sort of put us in a quandary about what dose of bevacizumab should we really be giving non-small cell lung cancer patients with chemotherapy. Some people think that combining bevacizumab with cisplatinum, you may not need as much drug compared to combining it with carboplatinum. Other people think that there's probably not much of a difference between the two drugs or combining it with bevacizumab. But looking at the phase 2 trial that Dr. Johnson and colleagues did at Vanderbilt with paclitaxel carboplatinum, and they looked at both doses 7.5 versus 15 milligrams per kilogram, and 15 milligrams per kilogram really was the winner in that trial. So I think there may be some differences in chemotherapy when combining this with bevacizumab. But clearly, at least with cisplatinum, we know that either dose, 7.5 or 15 milligrams per kilogram, basically improve progression-free survival compared to chemotherapy by itself. There, of course, at a higher dose, you can expect more toxicities, particularly hypertension. Right now, here in the United States, I'm still using 15 milligrams per kilogram. I'm not using the 7.5 milligrams per kilogram dose. I would seriously consider that if I did use cisplatinum-containing regimens. But here in the United States, we just don't use cisplatinum-containing regimens as much. Now, bevacizumab can also be given and has been looked at in the second-line setting. It is not FDA approved in that setting, but it's been combined with chemotherapy, either docetaxel or pemetrexed, and both improved progression-free survival compared to chemotherapy by itself. It's also been combined with erlotinib and actually had a very interesting increase in progression-free survival and as well as increased response rate. So there are various studies looking at using erlotinib and bevacizumab in the maintenance setting. There's a randomized trial for that indication, as well as a larger trial looking at it in the second-line setting, randomizing patients to chemotherapy with or without bevacizumab.
Yeah, that's really a fascinating concept of molecular therapy without chemotherapy. What I've heard some people talk about is, you know, the non-smoker or the patient with a gene mutation somewhere as part of or following first-line therapy or in that mix. Any times where you would consider that or where you've used it?
I haven't used it with erlotinib yet. However, I can tell you some anecdotes. So I've had a patient who actually proceeded to receive combination chemotherapy with bevacizumab. He did so well, we continued just bevacizumab by itself for about a year. At that point, his disease progressed, and we decided to start pemetrexed. We first started with pemetrexed by itself, because my thought was at the time, well, his disease is now growing through bevacizumab. It's not going to help any longer. So we gave two cycles, and his disease was stable at that point. Well, I would sure like to see the disease regress, and he was having some symptoms with his disease. So I actually added bevacizumab back on, and he had a response. So I think bevacizumab probably does improve the delivery of chemotherapy to tumors and actually may help the chemotherapy itself work better. And so that patient continued on bevacizumab as well as pemetrexed for over a year. And now his disease is now progressing again, and we are going to start at this point erlotinib. But I could potentially then stop pemetrexed and start erlotinib with bevacizumab. That would be one setting. I think in a patient who's already on bevacizumab, just like a patient who's on Herceptin, we may continue the antibody consistently throughout their lifetime and adding or taking away different drugs to try to control their tumor.
How old is this patient that you were talking about?
In his 50s.
And how long ago was he diagnosed with metastatic disease?
In 2006.
So it's been a couple years. He's
right.
Had a couple years. He's been on bevacizumab, I guess, the whole time?
The whole time.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You wonder, are there any predictors? I mean, he sounds like he's maybe somehow there's something about him and his tumor that's more favorable towards bevacizumab. Any way to try to pick those people out?
Unfortunately, not at this point. From the ECOG trial, there were some different molecular characteristics, at least serum blood levels of certain factors that may predict. But again, this was such a small subset of patients, we just don't know. We know it's not VEGF levels in the circulation, so there's something more than that in these patients that predict whether or not their tumors need bevacizumab to control them.
Now, the idea of bevacizumab, as you mentioned, somehow allowing greater access of, say, chemotherapy to the tumor. Well, what about greater access of biologics? I mean, erlotinib, I would assume, has no problem getting into the tumor. Is that right?
Correct. That's a thought. So it's unclear whether or not bevacizumab is helping erlotinib or they're just both drugs that are just truly additive.
Right now, of course, there's the major ECOG adjuvant study looking at bevacizumab. Can you talk about that trial and how things are going with it?
Well, it was finally opened last summer and really probably started just enrolling patients in the fall and now in the winter. And this trial actually takes all comers, patients with resected disease, and randomizing them to either chemotherapy or chemotherapy plus bevacizumab. And the usual criteria for bevacizumab, except for it does not exclude patients if they have squamous cell carcinoma. And it's interesting, the different platinum regimens that are being used on the trial are pretty much standard, what we use in metastatic disease. And it's slow going, I think, but I think as more and more centers actually open this trial, we're going to see great leaps and bounds in the enrollment. And so I think it's important for all of us to support this trial and talk with our patients about participating. Clearly, standard treatment is chemotherapy by itself, so they're not losing anything about participating in this type of clinical trial.
And I guess one of the controversial aspects of the study is that the chemo is all CIS-based. And we know right now from our patterns of care studies that we do for CME purposes that CIS is very commonly used by investigators, but not very commonly used in the adjuvant setting off study by docs in practice. What are your thoughts about that, and how do you approach that decision?
Well, the question is any chemotherapy better than none? And we just don't know. I think even in the metastatic setting and the adjuvant setting, we can see that cisplatinum is probably better than carboplatinum. In the metastatic setting, an advantage of response rate and a potential small advantage in progression-free survival has not equated into a true overall survival advantage. So the thought is the trade-off using carboplatin is okay because we're not going for cure in the metastatic setting. We're truly going for prolonged disease control as well as good quality of life. But in the adjuvant setting, it's the flip. We're actually going for cure. And these patients are being just treated with 3 to 4 cycles of adjuvant chemotherapy. So I stick with cisplatinum because I truly think it is a better drug than carboplatin. However, the big question is in patients with questionable performance status and whether or not they'll truly be able to tolerate cisplatinum-based regimens. In those patients, is any chemotherapy better than none? Probably. So using carboplatin in those patients, we hope will improve survival, but we don't have data for it. So if I saw someone in their 50s, otherwise healthy, no contraindications to cisplatinum, I'd give it to them and also try to sway them to use cisplatinum.
What would you combine with the cis?
Depending on the patient, again, you could do cisplatinum etoposide. That was in the ALT trial. Cisplatinum fenerelbine probably has the most data for it. But also cisplatinum and gemcitabine, cisplatinum and docetaxel clearly could be also used.
What do you see as the sort of advantages or disadvantages of each of those agents?
I think just mainly side effects and then the data. Really, the most data out there in the adjuvant setting is fenerelbine and cisplatinum. But at least in a lot of our hands, fenerelbine can be difficult to use, mainly due to the fact that it does have, I think, at least in my hands, a little bit increased side effects compared to gemcitabine, cisplatinum. But clearly, throughout the rest of the world, it's easily given.
Again, in our patterns of care studies, we find, again, a difference there in terms of the docs in practice versus investigators, and a lot of cis docetaxel being used by investigators with the thinking that the data in metastatic disease looks stronger for that combination. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I'm using some docetaxel cisplatinum based on some of that information, but again, that has not been prospectively studied in the adjuvant setting. But you can use some of that data to support its use in the adjuvant setting.
We were talking before about the proposed mechanisms of action or actions of bevacizumab. How do you think it's going to play out in the adjuvant setting? Of course, we have trials in breast and colon out there too, and everybody has that question. Any speculations?
Well, the thought is potentially bevacizumab might have its biggest impact on very small microscopic tumors. And so it may actually have even more benefit in the adjuvant setting compared to the metastatic setting, where some of the thought and some of the lab data supports the use of the multi-targeted tyrosine kinase inhibitors of the VEGF receptors. And so we're all, of course, glass half full people and hope that bevacizumab in the adjuvant setting will even have a greater benefit for those patients.
The last thing I want to ask you about is I know that you have a multidisciplinary thoracic malignancy conference at Hopkins, and I'm curious, what are some of the sort of case scenarios that sort of get people the most, let's say, anxious or debating or controversial?
Well, it depends on who's attending the tumor conference that day, but it's usually those patients who have questionable metastatic disease, so patients with stage 3A or 3B disease with a questionable adrenal nodule or questionable bone metastasis. Tissue is always the issue, but sometimes that's difficult to do, particularly depending on where that questionable metastasis is located. And also those patients with stage 3 disease that actually might end up going to surgery. The debate is always, do we do neoadjuvant chemotherapy or neoadjuvant chemotherapy and radiation in the hopes to downstage those patients' mediastinal lymph nodes or to clear those lymph nodes and then have those patients go on to surgery. Probably that gets the most people riled up and gets the debate going because clearly we want to benefit our patients but actually make the best decision for them.
So in what situations, I mean, can you recall the team coming up with the conclusion that they want to use neoadjuvant therapy off study?
Well, we do it quite a bit all the time. And those patients who have stage 3A disease, so mediastinal lymph nodes on the same side of the tumor, those patients with non-bulky disease, and we tend to define that as lymph nodes less than 2 centimeters in size, those patients we will consider seriously neoadjuvant chemotherapy and radiation therapy. Right now, our feeling is that chemotherapy and radiation therapy in those patients is probably better than chemotherapy by itself, just in the fact that you've got some local control as well as chemotherapy improving radiation use, as well as some systemic chemotherapy to try to control any micrometastatic disease. So we tend to use that compared to chemotherapy by itself. And right now, there's not many protocols out there for neoadjuvant therapy.
But now you're giving the therapy there with the anticipation of the patient going to surgery?
Correct. So usually patients, either their mediastinum is biopsied by endoscopic ultrasound with bronchoscopy or directly by bronchoscopy. And so we document that they have mediastinal lymph node involvement and then give them chemotherapy or chemotherapy and radiation therapy. And those patients then again go for biopsy, if possible, of those mediastinal lymph nodes. And if they're negative, they'll proceed on to surgery. Some patients we just can't go back in and biopsy, and those patients will go on to surgery if they've had a response.